They'd rounded two flights, kept on trucking. Manager confirmed that Natalie used to be an employee. 9 months ago, however, she stopped coming in. Never called, never showed up to collect her last paycheck. Manager still has it sitting in her personnel file. That doesn't sound good. Was Devin working there 9 months ago? Devin Goulding has been an employee in good standing for the past 3 years. Excellent bartender. Does have a tendency to flirt with customers, fellow employees, etc. But what are you going to do? His looks help draw in the crowds while deterring overly aggressive riffraff. That he could be a rapist? No way. Manager doesn't believe it for a second. Dee Dee arched a brow. Phil nodded. Exactly. Especially once Carol started asking about temper tantrums, rage management. Manager's story changed. As a matter of fact, in the past year or so, Goulding's behavior has taken a turn for the worst. In fact, he got in a fist fight with another customer several months ago. Manager had to clean it up. Goulding promised it would never happen again. So Goulding's roid rage was making itself known, Dee Dee guessed, and now he has ties with at least two missing women. Yep. They'd finally arrived on their floor. Dee Dee felt energized. Phil looked like he was about to keel over. So what happened to them? She asked out loud. Christy Kilker, Natalie Draga, where are they now? Phil shrugged, his look saying what they both already knew. Most likely, they were searching for bodies. And the number of dumping options in Boston? Just ask Whitey Bulger. Boston was a criminal's playground. Tex have seized his vehicle, Phil said, which made sense. If Devin had been hauling around bodies, he'd need a private means of transport. And if it has a navigation system, Dee Dee prodded, we should be able to download frequently driven routes. Whatever he did, wherever he took them, chances are he'd want to visit. Absolutely, Dee Dee agreed, to relive the glory, revel in his own power, all of the above. Maybe. She thought of the pictures of Natalie Draga, so many photos, clearly from a man either in love or worshipping from afar. Maybe, she decided, even to mourn. If Natalie was his first, he might not have intended to kill her. Maybe he really did just want to talk, or win her back, assuming they'd once been together. But when that didn't work... Phil shrugged. The motives for murder were many and varied. At this point, it mattered less to the team why Devin had killed the girls, and more what he'd done with them afterward. Sometimes detectives worked to put away the bad guy, and sometimes detectives worked to find closure for the families. Speaking of which, Dee Dee and Phil walked down the corridor to the homicide unit, where Dee Dee found Rosa Dane waiting for her, Samuel Keynes by her side. Rosa was definitely dressed for comfort, yoga pants, an interesting assortment of tops that seemed to end in an oversized blue flannel shirt. Her son's shirt? Maybe even her late husband's, given the frayed cuffs and hem. It definitely contrasted with Keynes's classically tailored suit. Rosa's face, however, was pure flora, or vice versa. The grim set of her lips, the hard line of her jaw... clear gray eyes that peered straight at Dee Dee and didn't flinch. Rosa's hair was lighter, blonde streaked with gray, but otherwise she could be her daughter's older sister. Dee Dee thought of what the victim advocate Pam Mason had said about how close Stacy Summers was with her mom. She wondered if Rosa saw the parallels with the relationship she used to have with her own daughter, and whether that helped her or hurt her when it came to mentoring the Summerses. She's missing, the woman stated the phrase, again eyes clear, jaw set. When Samuel called, she nodded her head in his direction. He didn't say as much about the questions he asked. I've been asked those questions before.
I suggested she meet with you directly, Keynes spoke up, and I assured her you were doing everything in your power to help locate Flora.
Dee Dee resisted the urge for sarcasm. Now was not the time. With one last parting glance at Phil, whose expression was completely sympathetic, she motioned for Rosa and Keynes to follow her to her office. After talking to Samuel, Rosa continued, falling in step behind Dee Dee, I tried calling Flora again, 4-5 times. She never called back.
It's not like her to go so long without making contact. She knows better.
Would you like some coffee? Dee Dee asked.
So I drove down, hoping for the best because that's what mothers do, but I knew. The entire way, driving, 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 I knew she was gone. Then, arriving at her apartment, seeing the police cars, I spoke to the Reichters. They told me what happened.
Dee Dee had finally reached her office. Not the largest or grandest in the unit, but perfect for private conversations. She ushered Rosa and Keynes inside, once again offered coffee, water, any kind of refreshment. Keynes shook his head. Rosa simply stared at her. Dee Dee took the hint.
"We are actively searching for your daughter," Dee Dee stated, making herself at home behind her desk. "We have concerns for her safety."
Rosa smiled. It was not a happy expression, and immediately Dee Dee recalled Flora sitting in the back of the patrol car just yesterday morning.
Survivors, Dee Dee realized. She was dealing with not one survivor of a traumatic kidnapping 7 years ago, but two of them. Mother and daughter. And the scars the ordeal had left on both of them. And Keynes, standing patiently beside the door as Rosa took a seat. What was his role in all this? Just what kind of victim specialist remained on such familiar terms with a mother and her daughter 5 years later?
"I'm here to file a missing persons report. That will help, yes?"
Rosa's tone was even. Dee Dee nodded. She kept her gaze on Samuel, who hadn't spoken since entering the office, and yet he seemed to assume he was part of this meeting. Why?
"I last saw her around 1:15 yesterday, Saturday," Rosa said. "You need to know that, too."
Dee Dee picked up a pad of paper, made a note. The woman was clearly a pro.
"She was dressed in her pajamas, blue, plaid cotton boxers, and a white T-shirt. Last I knew, she was planning on taking a nap after being out all night. I can go through her clothes and tell you if anything else is missing."
"That won't be necessary. You think she was taken from her bed, then, kidnapped straight from her apartment?"
"There were no signs of a struggle," Dee Dee said. "He ambushed her.
Drugged her?"
"We're still looking into that."
Rosa nodded. Her face remained set, not calm, nor simmering with the barely suppressed rage that animated Colin Summers's entire body. Instead, she was preternaturally composed. Like a fellow cop, Dee Dee thought. A woman who'd been there and done that before. The woman gazed up at Keynes. He gave a faint nod, and she reached down for her oversized cloth shoulder bag, digging around until she produced a manila folder.
"Recent photo," she said, placing it on Dee Dee's desk. "Written description. Her fingerprints are already on file."
Dee Dee took the file.
"What about Flora's cell phone password?" Dee Dee asked. "Because we're subpoenaing records of her texts and messages now, but that will take a few days, versus if we could access the phone directly."
Rosa rattled off four digits. Dee Dee wrote them down, then glanced up.
"That's not a birth date," she said.
"No, it's a random code, more secure. Flora was big on security."
A slight fissure in the woman's composure. Rosa squared her shoulders, soldiered on.
"She shared the code with me, however, more security, in case something happened to her."
"Were you worried about Flora, Mrs. Dane?"
"Yes."
No hesitation, no shirking.
"Do you know what she's been doing, even before Devon Goulding?"
"Yes."
Dee Dee leaned forward, resting her elbows on her desk.
"Mrs. Dane, do you think Flora was truly trying to save the world? Or do you think it's possible that Flora has a death wish? That she wasn't looking to continue her good work, that she was looking to end things?"
Rosa Dane's facade cracked, a wide, gaping schism that revealed a world of pain and sorrow and resignation, a mother's aching, powerful, powerless love for her daughter. Keynes reached out and gently squeezed her shoulder.
"She was my happy child," the woman whispered. "Darwin. He was old enough to feel the loss of his father, to know at an early age that a phone can ring and nothing will ever be right again. But Flora was just a baby. She didn't bear those kinds of scars. She loved the farm, chasing the hens, planting spring seeds, running through the woods, sneaking food to the foxes. She loved everything, everyone. All I ever had to do was open the front door, and she was happy. He put her in a box, you know? He shut her away in a pine coffin, day after day after day, and when he finally let her out, it was under the condition that she call him by her late father's name. Dee Dee got up. She had a box of tissues on the filing cabinet behind her. Now she placed it on her desk in front of Rosa Dane. But the woman remained dry-eyed, stoic, the kind of grief too deep for tears. Keynes's hand was still on her shoulder. He seemed in no rush to pull it away. "Do you have a child?" Rosa asked.
"A son, Jack. He's 4, currently obsessed with Candyland."
"And if something happened to him?"
"I'd do whatever it took to get him back," Dee Dee agreed.
"I did. I completed paperwork and designed flyers and personally worked the phones. Then, after that first postcard, I wore what the victim advocates told me to wear. I said what the FBI experts told me to say. I went on national television and begged for my daughter's life. Then I waited. And waited. And waited. Morning shows, nightly cable news, watched my son return from college and lose himself to Facebook drives, Twitter appeals. Neither one of us had any idea. We'd been a family, just a family of farmers from Maine, except then my daughter disappeared and for 472 days.
I'm sure the police appreciated your cooperation.
They didn't. Her voice was blunt. The investigators were hopeless. No leads, no clues. First it was all, don't call us, we'll call you. Then, later, why hadn't I done this? Why didn't I do that? As if suddenly it was my fault they couldn't find her. You know who helped us find Flora?
Dee Dee shook her head.
Jacob Ness. Him and his damn messages. At a certain point, postcards weren't enough. He started sending emails, even posting on her Facebook page. Escalation, they called it. But he emailed one too many times, and an FBI agent in Georgia was able to trace the IP address to some internet cafe that was part of a truck stop. But if not for that message, Flora would still be lost. We found her not because the police were that smart, but because Jacob was that stupid.
"Is that what you told Mr. and Mrs. Summers?"
Dee Dee asked. "Yes."
"Did you know that Colin met with Flora? Did you know that she had agreed to help find Stacy?"
For the first time, Rosa fell silent. She sat back, not saying yes, not saying no, but processing. "Do you think the same person who took Stacy has now kidnapped Flora?" she asked at last.
"We don't know what to think, but it's certainly a possibility."
"I love Flora," Rosa whispered. Dee Dee didn't say anything. "I will always love her. That's what mothers do, but I miss her." Dee Dee remained silent. Rosa looked up, eyes so much like her daughter's, searching Dee Dee's own. "My daughter disappeared March 18th. My beautiful, happy child, the girl who loved to climb trees and eat blueberries straight from the bush. I can remember how she looked, the full brilliance of her smile. I can remember how she felt, hugging me as if her whole body depended on it. The lilt of her voice, 'Bye, Mom,' as she was halfway out the door, always cheerful, never worrying because of course we'd see each other again. My daughter disappeared March 18th, 7 years ago. Jacob Ness destroyed her, as surely as if he'd fired a bullet into her brain, and now I love her. I will always love her. But this new Flora, she scares me, and she knows it."
"Did Flora ever talk to you about the Stacy Summers case?"
"Never."
"But you can believe she'd take an interest, go looking for Stacy herself?"
"I've seen her bedroom wall, detective."
"Was she getting counseling, therapeutic support?"
Rosa glanced up at Keynes. He'd finally taken his hand off her shoulder. Now his arm hung by his side. Was it just Dee Dee, or did he seem smaller somehow? Lonelier? "Samuel designed a plan for her re-entry," Rosa said, gaze on the victim specialist. "In the beginning, it included sessions with an expert in trauma, but Flora didn't care for those meetings. She claimed they didn't help. Ironically enough, it was her first self-defense class that made the most difference. After having spent so long feeling powerless, she delighted in discovering her own strength. Samuel approved. The best antidote for anxiety is confidence.
But she didn't stop with a few self-defense classes, Dee Dee filled in.
She became obsessed with both safety and security, and then other missing persons cases. All the other children out there who still haven't made it home again.
Do you think she could find Stacy Summers? Dee Dee asked.
I'm afraid that she could.
Afraid? Dee Dee didn't have to consider it too long. You think there's more to it than saving others. You think it's also about punishing the perpetrator.
Rosa didn't look at Keynes this time when she spoke. She stared straight at Dee Dee. After everything Jacob Ness did to her, he died too quick.
What happened when they rescued Flora?
I don't know. You'd have to contact FBI agent Kimberly Quincy out of Atlanta. She's the one who located Jacob and led the raid to rescue my daughter.
Dee Dee glanced at Samuel, who nodded. Were you there? She asked him.
No.
But you know what happened.
Only from hearsay. And as for anything Flora might have told me, we struck a deal that first day. She told me her story once. I repeated it for the official record. And now, we both keep her focused on the future.
She turned her attention to Rosa. You've mentioned a brother,
Darwin.
Are he and Flora close? Would she have spoken to him about what she was up to?
Darwin is in London, Rosa said.
Dee Dee shrugged. Which is why there's texting, email, Skype. She kept her gaze on Rosa, who was clearly hesitating. Interestingly enough, it was Keynes who spoke next, except not to Dee Dee, but to Rosa.
Have you told him?
No.
Wait, Dee Dee spoke up. You mean you haven't told Darwin his sister is missing?
Keynes continued as if she hadn't spoken.
Are you going to tell him?
Again, that hesitation. He's just getting his life back. If you could have seen him, what this did to him the first time she disappeared, the helplessness, the hopelessness. He gave up college, halted his entire life, and then she came back. Our own happily ever after, except she wasn't happy. The mood swings, the night terrors, the feeling that some imposter had taken her body. This wasn't my daughter, his sister. This couldn't be our Flora.
Rosa looked up.
He's just now getting himself together. How do I call and spring this on him? Again.
So what? He can drop everything? Again? Feel helpless and hopeless? Again?
Even if he did come back, to do what? No postcards this time?
At least not yet.
In fact, best I can tell, you have no leads at all.
So are you going to tell him? Dee Dee repeated Keynes's question, because she thought it was a good one.
He can't help you, Rosa said. Darwin has been away for years. He's doing his own thing, being his own person. Whatever Flora was up to, she wouldn't have told him. She's hurt him enough already, and she knows it. Now, if you don't mind, it's getting late. I'm tired. I need a place to stay, and I'd like to use my daughter's apartment, if that's possible.
You're not heading back to Maine? Keynes asked.
No.
Dee Dee had to glance at her watch, get her bearings. Sunday, 7 p.m. Where had the day gone? Just this morning she was working a dead rapist case, and now she had to think about it. Dee Dee said, Apartment is off limits for tonight. We're still processing. How long do you plan to stay?
How long will it take you to find my daughter?
Dee Dee didn't have an answer for that one.
I'll do my best to stay out of your way, Detective.
Rosa Dane gathered up her things, but don't expect me to remain on the sidelines.
My daughter isn't the only one who learned some hard lessons 7 years ago. You have your job. And now, I'm going to do mine.
Rosa swept out the door, Samuel Keynes following close behind. Hang on, Dee Dee tried to say. But neither one of them turned around.
Chapter 26 The girl is crying. I can't see her, only hear her in the pitch black. I should do something. Move, talk, assist. I can't. I just can't.
Somehow I've retreated to the far wall, sitting on the mattress with as much distance from the girl as I can get, knees curled to my chest, bound arms looped around my knees. I'm too stunned to react. I know how to take care of myself. Are you in pain? Are you hungry? Are you thirsty? Are you uncomfortable? No, then you're all right. I'm uncomfortable, I think wildly. I have training and preparation and experience, but I never saw this coming. I'm supposed to take care of myself, fight to save myself, not this. Her cries are quiet, more whimpers than sobs, the kind of crying done when you're exhausted and dehydrated, when you've already used up your supply of real tears and this is all you have left. I recognize this kind of crying. I've done it myself. Water. Somewhere along the way I dropped the water bottle. I should crawl forward and find it. I should crawl forward and help. It's not easy to do. In fact, it's excruciatingly difficult. Why? I'm the one who collects images of lost people. I'm the one who assigned myself as personal savior of Stacy Summers. So now, faced with the opportunity to really, truly lend a hand? I don't want her to be her. I don't want her thinking I can actually save her. I don't want her, I don't want anyone, depending on me. She's a resource. Is that a cold thought? A callous thought? But it comes to me. She's a resource. Her clothing? Items she might have in her pocket? Clips from her hair? Who knows? And if she's been allowed more freedom and privileges, say a belt buckle? Oh, the possibilities. Now I must move forward. I have to engage. She's a resource. And a victim must use all resources available to her. I pitch forward onto my hands and knees. Using my inchworm crawl, weight on my elbows, I wiggle forward in the dark. She's fallen where I attacked her, sprawled in front of the suddenly appearing, disappearing door, pulled shut, locked tight. I can't make out any sign it was ever there. The wall has gone back to being just a wall, the crying girl, the only evidence anything happened at all. Stacy? I whisper as I crawl forward. She doesn't answer, just whimpers. My bound hands connect with the water bottle, knock it sideways. I pause, feel around more gently until I can clasp it between my fingers. I wriggle forward, then bump against the girl's body. Leg, clad in denim, blue jeans. She's in real clothes versus my silly nightgown. The realization gives me hope. If she has pants, then maybe she also has a belt, with a metal buckle. That would be perfect. Oh, the locks you can pick, the things you can do with the tongue of a belt buckle. Stacy, I whisper again. Still no response. It doesn't feel right to simply pat her down, as if she were a suspect at a crime scene, but she won't talk to me either. I try to think of what I should do. That last day, when the police found me pouring through the hotel door and windows like a swarm of black armored ants, what had I been like? What had I wanted? I'd been crying, I can remember that, but it feels far away and distant, something that happened to another person another lifetime ago. There was a female agent there. She kept saying Florence Dane over and over again. The name confused me, tickled the back of my throat as if I should know it. Flora, she tried again. I think I spoke then. I think I said, my name is Molly. They exchanged looks, whispered responses. She placed her hand on my shoulder. My name is Special Agent in Charge Kimberly Quincy. I'm with the FBI. You're safe now, okay? You're safe. I flinched when she touched me, and felt myself go incredibly still. I wasn't shocked. I wasn't elated. I wasn't relieved. I was suspicious. I was steeling myself for the blow to come. She let go of my shoulder. She offered me water, introduced me to a couple of EMTs who wanted to check me out. Would you like me to call your mom? She asked. But all I could think of was Jacob. Poor, poor Jacob. And the blood all over my hands. I couldn't respond to the Kimberly agent. I never talked, or screamed, or cried. I simply held myself very still. That day, and the next, and the next. The girl who'd been born and raised in a coffin-shaped box. I'm not that girl, I remind myself now.
If I'm not that girl, then I must be the FBI agent, the Kimberly person. So what did she do? Spoke briskly and moved with authority. She ushered me through a flurry of medical exams and necessary questions while keeping up a steady flow of conversation, whether I chose to answer or not. She was normal, I decide. Sounded normal, acted normal. That's what she was trying to give me. After 472 days, she offered normalcy. I take a deep breath. Begin. My name is Flora. Is it just me, or did my voice falter at the sound of my own name? I repeat myself, this time for my own sake. My name is Flora, not Molly. I'm sorry I attacked you. Am I? Maybe. I don't know who she is yet, or her role in all this. Only a fool rushes to judgment. I'm going to try to help you. I'm sorry if it hurts, but I have to feel out the wound. I have some water. Would you like water? Her crying has puttered out. She appears to be listening to me. Her breath is still shaky and fluttery. Shock? Fear? Anything is possible. She doesn't say yes or no to water, but whimpers again. I'm going to touch you, I say now. I'm sorry, you probably don't want to be touched anymore. I hadn't wanted to be. But I can't see you. This is... I shrug, feeling a helplessness I already hate. The only way I can figure out what's wrong. I don't know what else to do. She's not talking, but at least is holding still. Is that an implicit yes or a mental hell no? I wonder if this is how the FBI agent felt 5 years ago. Less like she was saving a terrified girl, and more like she was dealing with a feral cat. Bare feet. That's my first discovery. The girl is clad in jeans, but no socks and shoes. Evidence she's not allowed to leave the house. I allow myself a small moment of mourning for the opportunities shoelaces might have presented. Resources, resources, resources. But no sense in mourning what you never had to lose. Next, I move my bound hands up her leg, fluttering my fingers across the line of soft, worn denim. Old jeans. Her personal favorites? I tug experimentally, not sure if that's appropriate or not, but it's as I expected. The jeans are loose on her. If these were her original pants, she's recently lost a lot of weight. She must be lying on her side, because next I come to the faint curve of her hip. She hisses in a breath, and I suspect I'm close to the wound. When the door first opened and I lunged forward, I was aiming for the stomach, a gut job. I'm hoping, for both our sakes, I hit her ribs instead. I feel weird, my cheeks flaming in the dark as I come to the waistband of her jeans. Lowriders, frayed to the touch. I can't help myself. I'm not trying to stroke a sliver of bare skin at her waist, but of course I do. She shivers, flinches in response, and I blush even harder in the dark. I have to force myself to continue. I need to determine if she has a belt. Leather belt, corded belt, anything with a buckle. No such luck. Okay, this is it, the stab wound. I have to be close, and I'm no longer embarrassed. I'm petrified. I can't see, not an inch, not a bit. What if I hit a piece of wood and drive it deeper? What if I hurt her worse? I'm not cut out for this. I didn't train for this. I'm supposed to be alone. I'm all right alone. Because now I'm uncomfortable. And uncomfortable is not the same as okay. My hands are shaking uncontrollably. I hold them right above her, but I just can't do it. I will hurt her. I will make things worse. I'll learn once and for all just how much damage I've done. Fingers, suddenly closing around mine in the dark. She doesn't speak, just the sound of her breathing. Not calm and even, but fluttery and frightened as she takes my bound hands and lowers them to the pool of blood at her side. I've made a mess of things. I don't need light to know that. I recognize the streaks of moisture, distinct in sticky feel and rusty scent. Blood combined with shards of wood. Slivers, really. Pine is too soft to make a great weapon. As I'd hoped, feared, I'd missed her belly, gouging against her ribs instead. Unfortunately, upon contact with hard bone, the pine had given up the fight, shattering into countless slivers. The girl's injury feels less like a stab wound and more like an encounter with a porcupine. She is crying again, hiccuping in the shaky, shuddering pattern of someone in great pain. I feel myself freeze up. I can't do this. The Kimberly agent never had to do this. All that blood. So much blood 5 years ago. My hands, my face, my clothes, but none of it was mine. I'm rocking back and forth. No, now is not that time. There are tears on my cheek. No, there will be no crying. I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor. I'm a survivor. And Samuel himself said survivors must never doubt what they had to do. I'm going to pull them out, I hear myself say. She has released my hand. Her body is quivering, definitely distressed. I try to move as gently as possible, but given that I have to find each wooden shard by feel, there's no way not to jar the wound. She hisses and moans, but remains passive beneath my clumsy touch. To the best of my knowledge, I'm not making any sound, but I can taste salt, so apparently there are tears on my cheeks as I gingerly pinch and pull each piece. Some of them are very small, definitely more like slivers. Two pieces are thick and bulky, shards. Do they hurt worse? Does it matter at this point? I stabbed up with two pieces of pine clutched together. The end result is a bloody, pulpy mess, somewhere between road rash and a pincushion. It's not going to work, I think, again and again. In the dark, I'll never get them all, only the obvious ones. And as anyone who's ever gotten a sliver knows, even the tiniest piece of foreign object embedded under the skin will eventually fester and inflame. But I don't know what else to do. So I keep at it, arms shaking from the strain of moving so carefully, salt coating my cheeks. 5 minutes, 10, 20.
But eventually I reach a point that when I wave my hand right above the wound, I can't feel any obvious protrusions.
Surely she has wood still stuck in her side. How can she not? But under these conditions, with not even a flashlight to work by, there's nothing else I can do. We need light, and bandages, and hydrogen peroxide, and, oh yes, a real doctor, not just me. I press my fingers gently against the wound. It feels about 2 inches wide, 4 or 5 inches tall, but maybe shallow. Or is that just wishful thinking? She hisses again, shudders. Does anything else hurt? I don't know what else to look for, what else to do. My fingers are sticky, covered in blood, her blood. She doesn't answer. I continue speaking out loud, making the decisions for both of us. I think we should leave it unbandaged for now, versus shredding more of my satin nightie for the cause. I don't think it's deep, but it's messy. It needs to dry out, scab over. Plus, I'm worried that trying to bind the wound will drive remaining splinters deeper beneath her skin. She still isn't talking. I have some water. I'm, going to pour some over the area. Rinse it out. Waste of a resource? I don't know. I launched an attack. Sure, I hit the girl, not my abductor, but my show of defiance most likely caught him off guard. Maybe even pissed him off. He could pull resources. No more dinner deliveries or other presents wrapped in cheap pine coffins. Which brings me to another question. The girl's hands. Is she bound, like me? And why was she sent into the room? I finish what I started, uncapping the water bottle and releasing a slow trickle over the girl's side. I am sparing. I can't help myself. Some lessons cost too much to learn. I rub a little on my hands, then wipe my hands as best I can against the thin carpet. I replace the cap on the water, then sit back on my heels. There's no polite way to do this, so I just do it. Finish feeling up the girl in the dark. Cotton shirt, maybe a t-shirt. Chest. Neck. Face. Thick shoulder-length hair. Her arms, which I trace all the way down to her handcuffed wrists. Then, because I know something about these things, I skim around the line of the metal bracelets, where I can feel the roughness of new scabs interlaced with the smooth ridge lines of old scars. You were kidnapped, too, a while ago, long enough for your first wounds to have had time to heal. The girl doesn't move, nor does she speak. Are you Stacy Summers? I ask. Nothing. I know your parents. I met with your father. They haven't given up hope. They're still looking for you. A slight hiccup. Surprise? Shock? A twist of hope? My name is Flora. I wait, my fingers still on her wrists, and then, just as I'm beginning to give up hope, I feel her hands curl against mine. Molly, she whispers in the dark. My name is Molly. 7 years later, that's all it takes. My blood turns to ice. My hands flinch, recoil protectively to my chest, and I know, and I remember, and I feel, and I know, I whisper. But this poor girl, my pain, my punishment, has finally found her voice. My name is Molly. Molly, 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 my name is Molly. I don't look at the viewing window. I don't look to the sealed-up wall where I now know there is a door. I look down at the carpet. I look deep into myself, and I think, all these years later, oh my God, what have I done? What have I done? What have I done? Chapter 27.
Go over to him. Go on, do it. Walk right over and tell that drunk-ass cowboy you're a kidnapped girl. Let's see if he'll rescue you. No? Don't think he'll believe you? Or afraid that he will?
Standing beside me at the bar, Everett's voice held an edge. He'd already tossed back several shots, not that it mattered. He'd been on a streak lately. Angry, surly, demanding. Nothing I did was right, and nothing I gave him made him happy. I didn't know what had changed, but something had. 3 days off before the next transport, he'd found us a cheap strip motel. In the beginning, I'd liked the time away from the rig, a floor that didn't constantly rumble beneath my feet, a view of green trees that didn't blur as they flew past on the interstate. But Everett, less driving meant more drinking, more sex, and none of it was ever enough. He just got angrier and angrier and angrier. Tonight he'd returned to the room with a bag in his hand, thrown it at me.
Clean yourself up. You look like a fucking loser, and smell even worse. What's with the hair, anyway?
Most of the time I wasn't allowed to shower, let alone shave my legs, but tonight I'd cleaned up, then looked in the bag to discover a dress. Kind of. Not a pink-flowered or yellow flowy sundress like the kind I might have worn a lifetime ago, heading out on a summer afternoon in Maine or enjoying a spring afternoon in Boston. No, this dress was red and slinky and very, very tiny. I trembled when I held it in my hand, and for a moment my gaze drifting up to the reflection of a girl in the steamy mirror, pale skin, gaunt cheeks, gray eyes so huge and shadowed in her face. Ghost girl, I thought. Then my entire body shook. Everett was waiting for me when I came out of the bathroom, tugging self-consciously on the hem plastered to the top of my thighs. No bra or underwear. Everett didn't believe in such things. He didn't say anything as he eyed me up and down, just grunted, drained the rest of his beer, then shouldered by me to scrub his face, slick back his hair. I tried to practice sitting while he was gone, fiddling with the halter top to cover more of my chest, plucking at the clingy fabric. In the bag I found a pair of platform sandals, strappy black. Not right for the dress, I thought, before I could help myself, but in another life, with another outfit, I would have liked these shoes. Again, that strange sense of déjà vu. Ghost girl. It came to me, the new dress, new shoes, combined with Everett's fresh rage. This was it. He'd always warned me, the day he grew bored, that would be that. He'd shoot me, strangle me, stab me, I couldn't even remember anymore, so many methods he'd discussed. But it all ended the same. My body dumped in Gator Alley. My mother never knowing what happened to me. Bathroom door opened. Everett stalked out, hands fisted at his sides. "We're going out," he announced. I trailed out the door behind him. Ghost girls didn't argue. Ghost girls never stood a chance. Bar was a small honky-tonk, peanut shells on the floor, Alan Jackson on the jukebox, crowded. Was it a Friday night? Saturday? Days of the week challenged me, as well as cities, states, basic geography. I saw men in jeans and t-shirts, women in tighter-fitting jeans and t-shirts, definitely no one in a clingy red dress. Patrons stared at me when we first walked in, gazes flickering to Everett, but no flashes of recognition, no twinges of suspicion. After all this time, I didn't expect anyone to look at us twice. Even now, one by one, they shrugged off the sight of a too-pale, too-skinny girl in a hooker's dress and resumed their drinking. Everett, after all these days, weeks, months of instructing me to keep my head down and my mouth shut, actually beamed at my side, which only heightened my tension. Ghost girl drifting through the bar, ghost girl ordering a beer. Did my head nod along in time with the music? Did I tap my fingers against the shiny wood top? Old habits from a former life, when bars were fun, and life was meant to be lived, and you never knew what good time waited just around the corner. Beside me, Everett chugged his beer, tossed back a shot, then demanded a second round. He could drink, hard, often, but rarely at bars. Too expensive, he'd complain. Why pay some assholes four times more for something he could buy cheaper on his own? But tonight he was running up the bill, drumming his fingers relentlessly against the scarred bar top, gaze roaming the room.
"You're the prettiest girl here," he said.
I paused, gaze fixed forward, hands wrapped tight around my sweaty bottle of Bud. I took a sip.
"You heard me." He tossed back his whiskey. "Prettiest girl here. You should keep your hair red. I like it."
He set down the shot glass, placed his fingers on the bare skin of my neck. I didn't flinch. All this time later, I just stared at him and wondered what he was going to do next. He laughed, ordered another round, and he kept his left hand curled around the nape of my neck, that hard, glittering look in his eyes. I sipped my beer. Ghost girl just trying to get through. Then I made a mistake. Glanced up. Happened to spot a guy at the end of the bar who was staring hard at me, Everett, who missed nothing.
"Go on. Walk right over to him. Tell him you're a kidnapped girl. See if he'll save you."
I shook my head slightly, reverted my attention back to my beer. My second, my third. The night was moving too fast, and Everett was scaring me.
"What's your name?"
Everett leaned down, his drunken breath whispering across my cheek. I didn't answer.
"Seriously, I mean it. What's your name?"
"Molly," I murmured, gaze fixed on my bottle of Bud.
"Nah, fuck that. Your name, your name, your name, your real name."
I looked up. I couldn't help myself. I stared at him a very long time. His flushed face, his overbright eyes. He's using, I realized. Something other than just alcohol. The mood swings, tension, all-night sex marathons. He was on something. Everett on a drinking binge was scary enough. This? I couldn't imagine.
"Please,"
I whispered, pleaded, though what did it matter? When had my begging ever made a difference?
"Do you know what today is?"
he asked abruptly. "No."
"It's our anniversary, sweetheart. 1 year. 1 full year, just you and me. Now how about that?"
He clinked his shot glass against my beer bottle, tossed back the whiskey, and twirled his finger for a fresh round. I couldn't breathe. I found myself staring at him, his red flushed cheeks, bloated face, greasy hair, but in my mind I was somewhere else. Far and distant, where the wind in the trees blew clean and crisp, and there, just for an instant, a fox darting behind a bush.
"You're dead."
He spoke the words matter-of-factly, jarring me out of my reverie. Bartender was back, shot in a beer for Everett, fresh Bud for me. I wish I had water. I really could use a glass of water.
"Now they look for missing girls. Always search the hardest the first 48 hours. Then, of course, make a show of it for a week or two or three. Feed headlines to local news. I know you saw your mom on TV one afternoon. Of course, she made a big show of it, because that's what happens for a bit. But 52 weeks later, you're not front page news anymore, little girl. Not even yesterday's leftovers. Hell, 6, 8, a dozen other pretty young things have disappeared between now and then. They get the headlines now. You? You're already filed away. Even now, some detective's sitting around trying to work up the courage to call your mom and explain about how gators get the job done. Think she'll do a service? I mean, even without the body. Maybe just a little gathering family and friends. Put your memory to rest. I couldn't breathe. You want that, don't you? His voice dropped low, sounded nearly concerned. You want your mama to move on with her life, right? Not suffer forever. Is that what happened to Lindy? I heard myself say. You fed her to the gators, too? He recoiled slightly, fisting his shot glass. Shut up, girl. Are you sorry? Do you wish you'd kept her longer? Is that why you still cry for her at night? Shut your fucking mouth. But I was on a roll. Powered by 3 beers, a too-tight, too-red dress, and the knowledge we were in a public place. Later he would make me pay, but for now, this moment on our 1-year anniversary, did you love her? In a flash, his left hand was on my neck, fingers digging in, slowly tightening, but I kept my eyes open, my gaze on his face, and in that second I saw it. Pain, sharp and brittle, followed by hurt, long and deep. I still didn't know how or why, but Lindy held power over him. Lindy, mythical, unknown Lindy, was everything I was not. Jealous? He drawled. Are you going to kill me? Yeah. Tonight? Maybe. Tomorrow? Probably then, too. You'll be all alone. Nah, just gotta head back to Florida. 1-year anniversary. Don't you know? It's spring break. I stared at him, on and on and on, and just for an instant, I could almost see us. After all this time of living minute to minute, of keeping my head down, of hoping, praying, begging just to survive, here we were. 1 full year later, Beauty and the Beast, a monster and his plaything, a young girl who was never going home again. Do it, I told him. And now my eyes were the ones that were overbright. Now, just squeeze your fingers. No one's looking. It'll be all over before they notice. Come on. I know you want to. Just kill me. Right now. His face darkened. He did want to. The idea intoxicated him, excited him. I could feel the roughness of his fingertips digging into my skin, itching to get it done. I'd die in a hooker's dress. But at least here, in a public place, he'd have to flee, leave my body behind. Funny, the things you can come to view as a victory. You're gonna fuck that cowboy, he said. What? The change in topic confused me. End of the bar. Asshole won't stop looking at you. Come on now. Walk on down. Make his day. No. Why? Too good for him? I didn't speak. Tell him the truth, I don't care. Tell him your name. What's your name again? I shook my head, clutched my beer. Why did he keep asking me that? My name, my name, my name, my real name. He was giving me a headache. You're done, he whispered. 1 year later, I bet your mom has already cleaned out your room. Packed up all your little pom-poms and teddy bears, put it all away. What do you think? She'll turn the room into a home office? Maybe a craft center. But face it, if you showed up on her doorstep tomorrow, there'd be no place for you to stay. I'm all you have left. You and me, girl, till the end of time. Or tomorrow morning, when I wake up sick to death of you. Now, cowboy, end of bar, go fuck him. No. His fingers moved, no longer squeezing, stroking the back of my neck as the hair prickled on my skin. You didn't want me, pretty girl like you, If I'd grabbed you drunk and sloppy off that beach, you'd never have looked at me twice. But now you got me. I've fed you, clothed you. Hell, I've taken you out and showed you the country.
I didn't speak.
I'm your first real man. First guy who told it to you straight, showed you the real world. Never lied, never prettied it up. Rest of your short life, wherever you go, whatever you do, you ain't never gonna know another man like me.
I risked a glance up into his feverish eyes.
I'm your world, Molly. Your whole entire world. I am your everything. Except to me. You ain't nothing but a piece of garbage. Here today, gone tomorrow. Replaced next time I head to Palm Beach. No one the wiser. Now, cowboy, into the bar. Do it.
No.
What the?
Not on our anniversary.
He paused, scowled. Studied me.
And I got it then.
Ghost girl. The feeling of deja vu that had been haunting me all night. Everett was mean. Everett was cruel. And one day he would kill me, dump my body in a swamp. But now, tonight, he was also right. 1 year later, I was never going home. The girl I had once been, she was dead. And now there was only me and my strange, twisted relationship with this man. I could keep going along, struggling through day to day, or... I reached out, and for the first time, of my own volition, placed my open palm on Everett's chest. He startled, couldn't help himself, and just for an instant I caught it in his eyes, uncertainty, longing, fear. Emotions I associated with Lindy. Now slowly but surely being transferred to me. No one likes being alone, not even the monster under the bed. I rose off my stool, took the shot glass from his hand, then I leaned forward and with my entire body pressed against his, I whispered, I want a present.
What?
A gift. For our anniversary.
Now, girl...
Your name. Your real name. Isn't that what you've been asking me all night? I think you're right. We are special. Meant to be. I want to know your real name.
1 year later, what can it hurt?
He eyed me, my lips so close to his own. I could see him thinking. I could see him considering. Then I felt his hands on my hips.
Jacob, he said roughly. My name is Jacob.
Pleased to meet you, Jacob. Now take me home, and I'll show you how much I appreciate a real man like you.
Chapter 28 Dee Dee arrived home just in time to put Jack to bed. His little round face lit up at the first sight of her, stubby arms reaching out, and she felt the customary pain in her chest. A love a suspected killer had once warned her about, the kind of deep, powerful emotion that would move mountains, and yes, if the occasion warranted it, justify pulling the trigger. But for now she didn't have to worry about such dark things. For now she got to nestle beside her little man, tucked in tight in his wooden red race car bed, and open up the runaway bunny. Alex watched from the doorway, a smile on his face. From time to time she glanced over at him, sticking out her tongue, crossing her eyes. Family fun with both her favorite guys. There had been a time in Dee Dee's life she never would have thought she could have all this. Now it amazed her that she'd ever gone without. Especially after a day like today, she needed this. Alex, Jack, her family, these moments, they grounded her. And not for the first time, she wondered what she would do if something ever happened to her son. 12 years from now, a phone ringing in the middle of the night, announcing her teenage son had disappeared. Dee Dee honestly didn't know where mothers like Rosa Dane, fathers like Colin Summers found the strength to carry on. Of course, family life wasn't all fairy tales. Dee Dee's job was demanding, and Jack had officially reached the age where he had his opinions on the subject. She'd been gone most of the weekend, home just in time for a story. So, of course, the moment she closed the book, climbed cumbersomely off the low-slung toddler bed, the theatrics began.
sticking out his bottom lip, staring at her with liquid blue eyes so much like her own. Alex had given him a bath before bedtime, and now Jack's light brown hair stood up on the top of his head, world's cutest mohawk. "Good night," Dee Dee repeated firmly, quivering, the bottom lip, the whole chin, and then full frontal assault, launching his little body across the toddler bed and slapping arms and legs around Dee Dee's body. She staggered back, hands dropping down belatedly to strong little arms that had already attached themselves with the strength of octopus tentacles. Serial killers she could handle, but God save her from the strength of a little boy who didn't want to go to bed. She could hear laughter behind her, Alex enjoying the show, and, of course, making no moves to intervene. He'd already spent the weekend battling the kid. This was all on her. Toddlers, Dee Dee had learned, were a lot like criminals. You basically had two options for management: promise a reward or threaten with punishment. She couldn't punish her son for missing her as much as she missed him, so she went with the promise of a second story if he'd get back into bed, which led to a third, then a fourth, before his heavy-lidded eyes finally sagged closed, and she staggered out of the race car bed, feeling Jack had probably won that war, but officially too tired to care. Alex was waiting for her in the family room. He had poured two glasses of red wine and had an ice pack at the ready. "I'm not sure which of these I'm looking forward to more," she said, gaze bouncing between the wine, the ice, the wine again. "How sad is that?" He smiled, helped her shrug out of her leather jacket. Ice pack on the shoulder, wine glass in hand. Life was good again. She sat back on the sofa, put her feet up on the coffee table, and sighed. "How is your vigilante?" he asked. "Missing." "Fled from the new sheriff in town?" "No." She turned her head against the sofa cushion to regard him seriously. "We think she might have been kidnapped, maybe even by the same person who abducted Stacy Summers." He made her start at the beginning, which, given how many hours she'd logged in the past 48, should have been draining. But the crazy part of marriage, Dee Dee had discovered, was that no matter what her day had been like, it didn't feel completely true or real or meaningful until she'd come home and shared it with Alex. Of course, him being a crime scene specialist, blood spatter more specifically, didn't hurt. He often saw or thought of things she'd overlooked. "Any video?" he asked now, referring to footage collected from local security and traffic cams. "When I left, the first batch of videos was just arriving. The new detective, Carol, promised to stay to sort through them." "Just the way you say her name makes it sound like you're biting into a pickle." "Nuh-uh." "Uh-huh." She glared at him. "In the morning, we'll see how she did." "But you're not releasing anything to the press?" She sighed, took a sip of wine. "Tougher call. It's going to be a media sensation, no doubt about it. Semi-famous former kidnapping victim abducted again? We want to get our ducks in a row. Confirm she absolutely, positively has been abducted before we lead with a story that's going to bring all the crazies out of the woodwork." "What kind of confirmation?" "A clip from the video feeds? Say an actual shot of Flora being dragged from her apartment? Or, now that we have the passcode to her phone, maybe some kind of proof she was definitely investigating Stacy's disappearance? Or, even better, had a solid lead that may have gotten her in trouble? Let's face it, second we announce this kind of news, it's going to be a media circus, which, unfortunately, will take time, energy, and manpower away from the actual search for Flora and Stacy. The mom doesn't mind keeping quiet for now. My impression is that she has no love for the press." "But if Flora really is missing," Alex countered, "then we need to find more witnesses and engage the public in the hunt, which calls for a press conference." "Gotta love the job," Alex said. She made a face at him. "Anything found at the apartment?" he asked. "No, except for her unmade bed. It's pristine. Mom, apparently, is a neat freak and had tidied up hours before. Given Flora's training, we suspect it had to be an ambush. Maybe he even drugged her. Otherwise, there should be signs of a struggle." "I could take a look at it," Alex offered,
I have some time before I have to head to the academy tomorrow, if you want a second set of eyes. Given how much we don't know at this time, I'd welcome a second set of eyes, or a third